Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In her debut, Vanessa Lindsay takes us on an uproarious journey of spirituality, humor, and humility. Meta Mom brims with stories unheard outside our most intimate moments, like teenage slumber parties, deathbed confessionals, and appointments with a gastroenterologist. Each humbling tale brings lifetimes of powerful lessons gleaned from healing and miracle making. Meta Mom provides sanity-seeking parents with heroic yet tangible steps to creating the harmonious family life they thought possible only in their dreams. For a decade, Vanessa Lindsay has been helping people resolve conflict through mindfulness. She's a gifted mediator and warm fuzzy workshop facilitator, often called the sleeper at conferences, as her playful, vulnerable approach to mindful teaching surprises and delights audiences. Vanessa earned her BA in speech communications with honors from Bridgewater State University, where she was awarded the school's first internship through the Washington Center, serving Tribune Broadcasting's Washington Bureau as a field producer, primarily covering the White House beat. She spent the next 20 years opening four profitable small businesses and writing her first book, a quirky perspective memoir entitled Meta Mom, A Mindful Guide to Managing Your Mood and Your Brood. Vanessa was trained and certified in professional mediation by Cornell University's ILR School, specializing in workplace disputes. She's collected dozens of empowerments in mediation, meditation, negotiation, and energy work, including certificates from University of Massachusetts Center for Mindfulness and Anadia Judas Psychology of the Chakras. She currently serves as operation manager at Mediation Works, Inc. in Boston. The mindful mother of several can be found at home in New England, telling Alexa to play songs by Dolly Parton and crushing her children at Mario Kart. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Spiritual Practice and Mindfulness, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Christy Edloff, a host of the channel. Today, I'm talking to Vanessa Lindsay for her new book, Meta Mom, A Mindful Guide to Managing Your Mood and Your Brood. Vanessa is also a communications expert who works on meditation and mindful communication. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thank you, Christy.
I wonder if you would just begin by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be interested in mindfulness.
So I'm a Massachusetts native. I've lived here my whole life, except for a few years when I've lived in Washington, D.C. as an intern for the Washington Tribune's broadcast side called Tribune Broadcasting. And then I also lived on cruise ships for a couple of years, which was really fun and strange.
It was really fun.
A great way to spend my early 20s. So came back here to Massachusetts and Boston area because I love it. And this is my home. And I had struggled with depression, really dysthymia, which is considered a low-grade chronic depression, right, for 22 years, I'd say, from ages 11 to 33. And I found mindfulness when I was 33 years old, very pregnant with my last child, my son. And I needed it to bootstrap my way out of something that just wasn't working for me anymore. And I knew it wasn't working for me. So that's how I discovered it. It changed my life. These practices changed my life. And it wasn't just mindfulness. It was spirituality. It was a lot of yogi stuff, a lot of like out there woo-woo stuff that I would practice, which was really fun. Because, you know, when I practice these things, I only want to do them if they're fun. If they're no fun, why would I go there?
Yeah, right.
So that's always one of the goals in my practices, is to have fun doing it. And when you can have fun healing, it makes all the difference. So anyway, in the name of fun and healing, people started to notice major differences and shifts in my life and would ask me, what are you doing? How are you doing this? And so my professional practice really started with family and friends, and it just grew from there. So I've always been a writer, and had been blogging for years on different topics, and writing for different magazines on different topics, more as freelance. And then I started writing about mindfulness, and it was just flowing. It was really natural for me. I felt like the content that I was providing people was really meaningful, and I was getting feedback like I had never gotten before. And eventually I realized I had a book in me, and that was Metta Mom.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
So we can start talking about that. Then I noticed that your book was kind of broken down into three parts. In the first part of your book, you really kind of focus on understanding your history and your triggers. And you kind of talked a lot about not placing those feelings that you have on the people in your life.
Yeah.
And how you came about doing that. And it reminded me a little bit about, I don't know if you ever read Dan Siegel's book, Parenting from the Inside Out, where he talks a lot about being able to understand, like, what's going on for you so that you're not placing them on your children or the people you love. And you kind of discussed a lot about journaling and how it helped you discover some of your triggers and to become unstuck. And I wonder if you could share that with people and kind of, I know you have nice guided questions at the end of them, but for people that haven't read your book, kind of talking a little bit about that process.
Writing has been my lifeline since I was a little girl. So I wrote my first book. I think I was about 9 years old. The book was written from the perspective of a young boy going through puberty.
Oh, that's so interesting.
And I had no brothers. I barely had a father in the house at the time. And for me to write a book about going through puberty was from a boy's perspective was such a reach, and so out of my wheelhouse that I don't even know how I got through the first chapter. but anyway, that's how I started writing and really falling in love with the craft. And so when I turn to healing practices, I generally turn toward things that are familiar. I think that if you can be a little bit comfortable when you start healing your life and your mind and your body, then it'll make the practice easier to sustain. I did read Dan Siegel's book, and that was one of the things that I would find as I was reading all these self-help books is that they would always, most of the time, I mean, sometimes people would refer to their own experiences.
Right.
Dan Millman wrote in one of his Peaceful Warrior. That was his, you know, memoir for him. But he wrote sitting down in meditation one day, and his kids are coming in and they're bugging him and climbing all over him, and he's like, "Can't you see I'm meditating? Can't you see I'm peaceful right now?" And so I really appreciated when authors would share these moments of realness and vulnerability from a space of personal experience. And so, you know, a lot of these self-help books that I was reading were experts that were talking about their clients' experiences or their research studies. And what I knew for sure was that healing was really messy. Right. And I was really interested in vulnerability and just sort of like turning over my mess and seeing what could come from the compost of my life. And vulnerability, I think, is one of my superpowers. I think I have a few superpowers. And if I could tap into that and be brave enough to share like some of the kind of embarrassing things that I've been through, especially when I was in the prime of my depression, then it could really help people. And I also, my intention was really touching my own community and being a voice for the people that I could touch. I don't have a huge following. I'm not a celebrity. I'm very accessible to people. And I think that when people have real problems and are looking for practical solutions and practical advice, it's really helpful that they can turn to a neighbor. Tip O'Neill, the late great Tip O'Neill, former Speaker of the House, said, "All politics is local." Another great Massachusetts guy. And you know, I know that applies to politics, and I really do believe that applies to pretty much anything. You know, if you really want help, you can watch Oprah and you might get inspired, but you also need somebody who's willing to like get deep in the mud with you, and that you can access. And I like to be that person for people.
That's actually a huge strength, and it's definitely something that's needed. I think there is something very real, and I did appreciate your willing to share your stories through your depression and also the different ways that you kind of came at it with your dysthymia and trying to understand like what's going on and recognizing that there was multiple steps, as you kind of talked about your dad, for example, and like you dealt with one piece of your dad through journaling, and then later on there was like other pieces that you kind of discussed. And so just, I'm wondering what that experience was like for you, kind of how you were seeking other spiritual healings or looking for other ways to understand yourself and find your triggers. And again, like I know you did talk a lot about this in the book, but just, I find it, you know, inspiring for people to recognize that there's lots of ways to go about this.
Yeah, that's so true. And I hope that my story speaks to the people who can resonate with me and my approaches, because my approaches will not work for everybody. I am extremely nonlinear in the way I think and in the way I live my life. And I've always been that way. I think the difference between me then and me now is that I trust the universe and the way it's working through my life. And so I don't get so uncomfortable with the nonlinear. But there are some, there was like a spaghetti test that I had to experience in order to find the right things that worked for me to move myself through this yuck that I'm like constantly referencing throughout Metamom, the yuck of my life, which really stemmed from this trauma of rejection, abandonment, desertion by pop, by my father. So I knew it was a, I always knew it was a problem. I didn't understand the depth at which it was affecting me and my relationships and my children. And once I started to understand that I was passing it forward to my kids, then everything catalyzed. And I was like, ooh, I gotta experiment. I got to find solutions here, because this ain't going to work for my 2-year-old who's sitting across the counter from me asking why I never smile.
That's heartbreaking. When I read that, I was like, oh.
Yeah. I shared that at a book reading when I first started talking about Metamom publicly, and I could not get through that line without sobbing. It's really hard to see your children in pain and to know, or to, it's like she's feeling hurt by watching my hurt. So she's exercising some compassion, which is really beautiful. So I know there's a lesson in it somewhere for her. But I was able to see her compassion, register it as hurt in me, and then start taking action. So it's like, if you can capture these tiny moments and put words or feelings or labels on those shifts that occur with the tears and with the, like, this trauma that's bubbling up into the present moment, this past trauma that's bubbling up, like while you're sitting at the counter with your child. And I'm sorry, I'm just realizing your audience likely probably hasn't read the book. So when I first started to really understand what was going on, it was when my daughter Penelope, which she was my first daughter from scratch. So I have a stepdaughter who is 9 or 10 years older than her. And then and then I had Penelope. So she was a baby. And I'm just doing my mommy thing and, you know, scrubbing counters and making food and playing, you know, toys with her. And I just looked miserable, and I didn't realize it until she said, "Mommy, why don't you ever smile?" And it just inspired this like full on ugly cry. Like my face was contorted. I was sobbing, like mascara running down my cheeks. And I just remember looking at her. She didn't understand why I was sobbing, but I was like, I don't know why I can't smile, but I'm going to figure it out. And
that's kind of what the movement was for you.
That was the movement. And even still today, you know, I'll have these times where, you know, I'm like living my bliss as best I can, but even today I'll have moments where I can see the yuck stirring and I'm like, oh, I see you. I'm not going to let you come up all the way and get me, but I see you coming. And when I do, sometimes I'll warn my kids and be like, okay, I've got some yuck that's stirring up for me, but like, I want you to watch me closely and watch me rise out of it. Like, watch me, because I'm going to do great things and I've got magical powers and I'm not afraid of having you watch me go through this because I know that I'm going to get to the other side. So like, because
well, it teaches them too, right? Like there's the mirror neurons that we know exist that kids watch us and they see how to be in the world.
And I think they see how dedicated I am to my, like my wellness, my, my like mental stability. I really care about my mental health. I really care about kindness. And I care about helping people and doing my best. And I think when they see me trying so hard, they can reprioritize that for themselves too. And for their friends, you know, and pass that forward onto their friends. So that's sort of like the drop that causes the ripple, that causes the wave and sort of like washes over the whole world. But yeah, this is a really long answer to your question, but, tapping into all of those practices was, like I said before, a spaghetti test for me. And sometimes they worked. Sometimes they were really weird. Sometimes I would learn spiritual practices that didn't necessarily work for me, but they allowed me to have conversations with other people who were in their yuck. And I could pass on something that might work for them, and it did work for them. So I think that's kind of the, you know, just finding a way to meet people where they are and using whatever tools you have in your toolbox, even knowing that even if it doesn't work for me, it might work for somebody else. There's a reason I have this tool now, and I'll put it to use at some point, whether it's for me or whether it's 2 years from now when I'm coaching a client.
That's great. And so it sounds like, and because you kind of broke it up, and one of the things you did say, and there's a quote that you had talked about, but also that it's like we have to kind of work on ourselves before we can then also be there for others in our life. And so, because then you do shift the first part of the book, you really do talk a lot about your experience and the different things that you've tried. Similarly, to kind of give people an idea, like you mentioned journaling, and there was meditation, and I'm trying to remember. You have a lot of them, like traveling, walking, exercising. And then I guess like when people think about working, is there one that you feel like works best for you? Or is it depending on the situation?
For me, this is interesting. So,
or maybe it's evolved too.
I'm constant. We're all constantly evolving, right? So, so the three portions that I broke the book down into were based on a lesson that I learned from the Dalai Lama. I had the pleasure of learning from him in person a couple of times in Boston.
That's pretty amazing.
It was great. You know, when you sit a few feet away from this man and you take in his energy and his lessons and his intensity and the things that he says, they just stick to you. Bonk you in the head and they just resonate. You start to embody, something happens and you just start to embody the lesson without even trying. And that's why I think it's so special to have moments where you can learn in person from a guru like that. But I say this in the book, he pointed this finger at all of us and he was sort of making eye contact with everybody and he's all broken English. And he's like, first you, then your family, then your neighbor, then whole world. And he starts laughing in this like strange way. And we're like, okay, that wasn't really funny, but he's laughing and we all start laughing. And it's like this thing that spreads all throughout this big room of people and we're all laughing. But that was real. That was such a powerful message for me. And when I was organizing the book, I was like, how do you organize this? Because it is so nonlinear. And how do I, mm-hmm. how do I put all this together? And I kept coming back to like, that's a great way to organize it. And that's meta, is, you know, working through yourself first. So when it comes to all these different practices that you can engage, I think that over and over and over, no matter what the practice is, it all comes back to the practice of metta, mm-hmm. which metta is a formal practice, but it's also sort of like a metta, M-E-T-A, practice right. of metta. So,
And for those that don't know, do you want to explain a little bit what metta is?
Yeah. So metta is a Pali word that means loving kindness. And mm-hmm. it's a Buddhist practice where you are offering loving kindness first to yourself. And then you offer it to a benefactor, somebody that you love, non-romantically, typically. And then you offer it to a neutral person. And then you offer that same loving kindness to a person who challenges you. And then you offer it to all sentient beings. So it's like this this sort of like organized way of starting with yourself and then like pushing on the creepy outskirts of your comfort zones to be more and more inclusive. So you start with, sometimes starting with yourself, you're the hardest person to forgive, or you're the hardest person to wish love to. Because we're so hard on ourselves.
Right. We all have that inner critic.
Oh, we're so awful to ourselves. Yeah. So sometimes that's the hardest. And I'll even say like, hey, if you can't do it for yourself, just like give yourself a little like peck on the cheek and then move it on to somebody that it's easier. So like, even if it's your dog, if you can only offer metta to your dog right now, just offer metta to your dog and then try doing yourself again later on. I think like you do the best you can with whatever stage and whatever mindset you're at right then, and just like keep expanding. It's an awesome practice. It's always changing because every day it's a different problem. Every day there's like a different, you know, antagonist in your life. Mm-hmm. Every day there's a new world drama that you're looking mm-hmm. to like resolve internally. So it really grows with you. So I think that metta practice is great. Although I don't like walk down the street these days being like, may I be peaceful entities? May you be peaceful entities? May she be peaceful entities? I don't do that on a daily basis, but there are some practices that I do turn to, including forgiveness. And I'll always start with myself. And then I forgive the person in front of me. And, you know, we go from there, or like non-judgment. You know, I really try not to judge myself too hard. And then I work to not judge other people too hard. So that's sort of like in the evolution of my personal practice. That's sort of where I am right now. Although I feel like I have mastered forgiveness and non-judgment. Mm-hmm. But there are tools that I revert to every day. And now like I'm sort of in this whole world phase, and I have been mm-hmm. here for a while, and I'm really like, I'm just manifesting stuff like crazy. I am creator. It's amazing.
That's great.
Yeah. And that's really, you know, this is it. Like, I am practicing the embodiment of creation. I am a creator. I am the creator. I have the creator inside of me. And so this is where I'm moving from here. And it just lends itself to all kinds of like gratitude, bliss, joy. When I do fall back into those like little divots of yuck, there's always forgiveness, non-judgment. Those are the two bad boys that really get me through.
Well, that's part of what you've learned, what's really worked for you. Like, if I can forgive myself, which I think there is a lot of research also about like self-compassion and loving kindness, kind of like what you were talking about, the meta, right? And even with both of those, there is this idea of like forgiveness and not judging yourself so harshly. And that was one of the things I also really appreciated, because then you kind of went to your children, and there was two things that one made me laugh. You talked about your daughters going on a ski trip, or your whole family was on a ski trip, and you're fighting, and you kind of decided that, okay, we're hugging it out. And they're like, really, mom, right here? And you're like, yep, right here. And you set your timer and you have this whole philosophy about why. And it did make me laugh because I was like, I don't know that my children would do that. I don't know if they would be like, no, I'm not doing that. So I appreciated that. And then also just like you talked a lot about practicing that once you master non-judgment for yourself, you are able to then kind of apply it to your children. And really you talked about having the adolescents and kind of how they're really struggling to figure out who they are. And I feel like kids do tend to practice acting out and yelling more at home than they do in public typically. And that you want them to have that practice place. And you talked about how even though you still have hard times, that allowing your children to kind of be and find out who they are with that non-judgment. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you get there, like with your family. And because I think that is a challenge for a lot of people.
I think it's really hard work. I think there's this idea and that people think that meditation, mindfulness, it's some version of perfection. It's like if you're a meditator, if you're a mindful person, if you're a spiritual person, that must mean you're perfect, or you think you're perfect, or there's some sort of like righteousness involved in those labels. And again, like going back to the beginning of this conversation, I really was interested in presenting a version of mindfulness that looked highly imperfect and downright messy sometimes. And then like dappled with these moments of just wanting to like high five yourself. Like I nailed that one. It was weird. And people looked at me like I was crazy, but like, screw that.
Right.
I spiked the football on that one and it worked. So I hope that people see both sides of my practice and that like there were a lot of screw ups and there are a lot of successes. And then you learn from both. And I think all that, and I think like having these really open dialogues, with the kids about the process of parenting and how difficult it is. I think they strangely appreciate it when I can look at my teenagers and be like, you know, I don't know exactly what I'm doing right now. And this is really hard for me. So if you can, I know you're angry and I know that you're impatient and feeling super anxious. I really want to help you get through this. I just don't quite have a solution for you right now. And I need some space so I can like get centered, mull it over. And then I'm going to come back to you because things escalate really quickly with the kids. Your mom, you know, right. Sometimes it gets out of control and then they're out of control. You're out of control. Everybody's crying and screaming at each other. And then somebody's swatting. And then, you know, it's so hard to, reel that back in once it's out of the box. You're like, oh shoot.
Yeah, we're all having temper tantrums together.
It's like everybody's exploding and melting down. And then all you want to do is like lock yourself in a closet with a bag of Halloween candy.
Right.
So, or a glass of vodka or whatever. I think that whatever the moment is that you catch yourself is the right moment. Because whatever's happening, it needed to get that far so that you could become aware.
Right.
That's the point. That's what it takes for you to get to become aware. It changes every day. Like sometimes your threshold is much different. And some days you're gonna be a superstar mom and you're gonna be aware, you're gonna become aware before it even begins. And you're going to nip that in the bud. But it's like jogging. Like some days you can jog 25 miles and some days you can't get around the block. Like your mind is the same way and your threshold is going to be different every day. So I think that's the point where you just have to keep forgiving yourself and being like, okay, like this is just where I am today. I'm going to do my best with what I have. I know I just screamed at my kids. I'm going to apologize to them because I need to today. And we're going to like start again. And so I think like if you can find some sort of metaphor, like the jogging thing to present to your kids in the moment to be like, I today's the day I can't get around the block, guys. Like I'm trying really hard. I just can't do it. Like let's team up here and work together so that we can find some peace in this house. One of the things that I'll often say to my kids, and I think that it's pretty effective, is like there's a whole lot of mess outside our doors. Like, you can walk into school and there are people having dramas everywhere. You can go to Washington, D.C. and you see there are politicians fighting. You go to a different country and you see wars on the streets. Like, inside of our home, we have almost total control because we have control over ourselves. So if we can create peace in this home, like, let's do that. This is an opportunity for us. And let's, like, let's shoulder this one to the mountaintop and feel really good about ourselves at home. And I think that they appreciate that. So, you know, and sometimes they don't want to talk. Sometimes they don't want to hear my lectures, or sometimes they don't want to like be part of this mindfulness thing that I'm always perpetuating at home. And that's fine. Like, I'm just really trying not to judge them, because they're here to make mistakes. And if they don't make mistakes, then they're not living a life. They're not growing. You know, the only place that we're going to grow is on the creepy outskirts of our comfort zone. And if they're too comfortable, then there's no growth. What's the point? That's not fun. It's fun to grow. It's fun to explore. Sometimes it's really fun to screw up and fix it. I co-facilitated a big corporate negotiation last week. And there was a guy, it was like 25 people, two companies who were coming together and trying to like work out their differences and work together productively. And there was a guy who had just joined the company 4 weeks earlier. And we kind of had an aside at one point, and he said to me, and there was some drama that was stirring, and he said, you know, I really love this because it's fun. It's fun to solve problems. You know, what am I going to do? Am I going to go to work every day and, you know, stare at a computer and dial it in? It's like, I could do that, but I'd rather be doing this because it's exciting. And I think it was such a, like, for me, it was a little shift of a moment where I was like, oh yeah, that's some really good perspective. And you can apply that to the home too. Of like, oh, we got a mess on our hands. Guys, let's rub our hands together and see how we're going to solve this one. So,
It's reframing the idea, right?
Like, yeah.
We don't have to be afraid every time there's a mess. We can kind of take a deep breath and let's work together. And how can we come up with solutions?
Yeah, and be collaborative at home, and then you can take that collaboration outside of the home too.
Right. Yeah, I think that's great. There was a, because I have been doing some meditation, it is hard for me, but one of the things that I really appreciated is, and I think it was in Sharon Salzberg's book, 28 Days of Meditation, and she's talking, she was at a retreat and overheard like the famous Buddhist monk who was leading it kind of asked people, so how long were you able to meditate before your mind wandered? And the one person said to him, I did it all day. It was amazing. I just did it all day. And the master says, oh, that's interesting, because I was only able to hold it for two or three breaths.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of that idea that, like, I think I agree with you that people kind of think that some of these things equal like this calmness or this like that your mind is supposed to be completely clear. And that's really not the goal of it. The goal is, like you said, catching yourself when your house is completely chaotic and everyone's melting down and being able to like pause for a second and take that deep breath and get recentered and then kind of be there in a different way.
Yeah. And really trying to find the creative way back to composure.
Right.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I have a big long list in the book of all these ways to stimulate your memory.
Yeah.
When like you're losing your mind at home, you need triggers around the house, like environmental stimulants to help remind you, because the hardest thing about practicing mindfulness is remembering to practice mindfulness. We just forget, you know, we're like so caught up in what we're doing. It's just not on the forefront, but if you can set your environment up with little symbols.
Do you want to give some examples for people that?
Yeah. So I paint my toenails in rainbows. I'm often like barefoot. And so especially I had a meditation studio for 2 years, and I would teach like 3 or 4 classes a day, and I was always barefoot. And so especially for me, when I can sort of, for a long time, my default was dysthymia or depression. That's always sort of like there in the background for me. So when I feel myself like that feels a little bit gray or like dark blue to me, these feelings that are in my body. I can look down at my feet and be like, oh yeah, I get rainbows on my feet. I have access to joy. I forgot I can smile through this, or I can find solutions, or I can take another breath and start again. Like painting light switches blue, like turn on the light and remember to be happy. There are so many, like if you love flowers, put fresh flowers on your kitchen table every day. Mm-hmm. And every time you see them, like stop and smell them, or just remember to be grateful or to feel fresh, or, there are so many, a dog collar is great, or like a little, if you put a little bell on your cat's collar when mm-hmm. she runs around and it jingles, that could be a great stimulator.
And I really appreciate those, because I think for a lot of people that are parents, they think about meditation and they're like, when am I going to fit that into my day? And a lot of the things you're mentioning are these little, like, it doesn't have to be sitting for an hour a day, right? It can be stop and smell the flowers and just making yourself more mindful of being present in the situation. That's kind of the idea of smelling the flowers that are in front of you.
Yeah. And you know, I think one of the best and easiest and freest, it's so free. You don't have to pay a dime for it. You don't have to search for it. It's not hiding anywhere. I always say to my kids, like, this particular thing that I will share in a second, it's not like under their beds with the dust bunnies. It's not hiding behind the milk in the refrigerator. You don't have to go take out money out of the bank to pay for it. It's the sky. And you can look up at it at any time and be reminded that you're alive, and that you're connected. And it's the same sky that everybody else is living under, no matter if they're the richest person in the world or the poorest person in the world or the most powerful person in the world or the smartest person in the world. We're all living under the same sky, under the same conditions. And it's really, I think, uniting. And one of my theories that I also share on Metta Mom is that God is blue. And mm-hmm. I think that's why the sky is blue, as a reminder of God, and that no matter where you are and no matter how bad things are, all you have to do is open your eyes and God is everywhere, and you can see that source energy from a prison cell as long as you've got a window.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Yeah.
One of the things I was also intrigued about in the book is you mentioned, and you said, I'm not going to talk about it now, but it did intrigue me, that you talked about taking your daughters, each of them, I think you've taken, but on a mother-daughter spiritual adventure.
Yes.
And your idea of like helping other people come to this. And I just was wondering if you could talk about that experience.
I think it is the best.
And you have a son as well too, right? So maybe it's also a mother-child spiritual adventure. I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. So my next trip that I need to take is with my son. And it's a couple of years before I'll take him, but I'm going to take him to Greece. There are a couple reasons. A very practical reason why, or two very practical reasons why this is so great, is because one, I'm a single mom, and it's expensive to travel, and I love to travel, so it's important for me. It's become important for my kids because over the years, travel is something that we've always prioritized, and just because I was a single mom, I didn't want to deprive them of the opportunities to explore the world. And I can't afford to take all of three of my kids on, you know, a big adventure like that. But I can squeeze out one at a time. And so I'll feed my kids ramen for weeks at a time so that I can afford a plane ticket. You
should
have priorities. That's right. Whatever it takes. There's nothing wrong with ramen noodles.
No.
Yes. So I took my daughter for her 13th birthday. My daughter Penelope, I took her to Peru. And these trips that I take, they have to have a spiritual component, an adventure component, and a cultural component. And so we went to Peru and we did Machu Picchu, we did Cusco. We had like shamanic healings at every place we went to. We went with two dear friends of mine who are shamans and they're super talented. Sacred Peru Tours, I think is their company's name. And I highly recommend them for anybody who's listening.
That's great.
Extraordinarily talented people and so well connected in the community that you're just – in safe hands the whole time. Really beautiful. That was an incredibly powerful trip for me. And I believe it was for her too. So I think the other practical reason is that when you travel with three kids at a time, it's hard to have fun because everybody wants to do something different. They're different ages. They want different things. But then there's this sameness that comes along with that too, in that if you get a trinket for one, you've got to get the same trinket for the other two. And so you end [S2] Right. [S1] Up spending all kinds of extra money on this stuff that I don't really want to bring back to my house. So I feel like I could be more generous with them and also have more freedom in the traveling experience. And like, hey, so when I took my my second daughter, Scarlett, to France, so we traced the steps of Mary Magdalene. And she balked. She was like, I don't want to go and have like a spiritual adventure with you. And I was like, well, then let's not go to France. Then we don't have to go. That's fine. And she's like, wait, I want to go. So when we got there.
Is that or not?
Yeah. So she loved it.
Yeah.
And so while we were traveling around, we could make decisions that for just the two of us. So it was great. I was like, okay, so we could eat crepes and get fruit at the bodega, at the little convenience stores every day, and just eat crepes and fruit all the way through and not spend money on expensive dinners. And then instead, I'll take you back to school shopping in Aix-en-Provence. And she's like, let's go shopping. So
it was so funny.
Yeah. So we had the spiritual component, which was amazing. And she loved it. And it was very powerful. And it connected her to these like really big concepts and really big ideas that I think otherwise she wouldn't have had the opportunity. But it also involves a lot of hiking and movement and adventure. We went canyoning in the gorges of Verdun, which was exciting. And had great train rides and met friends, and we went back to school shopping. So, you know, it's these one-on-one trips are extraordinary. And for me, they, required a lot of pre-planning. And when I got back, I was like, geez, I need to get a bunch of moms to come out and do this with me with their 12, 13-year-olds. Because I think the other thing is, you know, like Jewish people will have a bat mitzvah as a coming of age. And so I've attended a couple and I understand now how special this time of life is and how important it is to communicate and be really clear about who your children are and who they're growing into and what are the next steps for them. Mm-hmm. What they appreciate about what they've been through and what they look forward to moving into their futures. And these trips for my girls provided me opportunities to just get to know them at a really critical time in their lives. And
How you chose that age, like around 13, 12, 13, that we're going to take that trip?
It wasn't a conscious decision for me. It presented itself. And I saw it as a great opportunity and I captured it. I had taken the kids on other trips too. Like, I had taken each of them on a local trip, in the States, one at a time to visit family one at a time. And that was really nice too. But to have these like big adventures, that Peru tour came up and I was like, oh my God. And I, you know, once you know how opportunity speaks to you and resonates inside your body, when that tour came up for me, it was like chills everywhere. At first I thought I was going to invite my sister. She couldn't do it. And I was like, wait a second, it's on Penelope's birthday. I should be taking Penelope on her birthday. And then another wave of chills and then presented it to her and just everything was working out. The timing worked out. She, you know, it was perfect. And I was like, okay, this is a good path for me.
That's great.
Yeah.
So I know we've been taking up a lot of your time, but before I let you go, I'm just wondering if you want to share what you're working on now.
Yeah. So, it's interesting just how the path unfolds if you just keep on being brave and walking it, taking risks. So clearly I'm in my office right now. You can probably hear my computer like consistently sending me email messages. So I work in a mediation firm now. So I work in downtown Boston. The firm is called MWI, Mediation Works, Inc. It's a nonprofit and we do corporate facilitate corporate mediations, negotiations in the workplace. And we do a lot of divorce mediations So when I went through my divorce, I came here and I had a tremendous experience. It was a good divorce as far as divorces can go. That, you know, that saying, oh, it was a good divorce. I actually had a good divorce.
It makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference. And mediation, it just eased everything. And a lot of it is the approach that my ex-husband and I had coming into this process. And I think that's why we were so successful in it, because he's a really nice person. And I hope to think that I'm a really nice person. Mm-hmm. And you can be nice people and still be at odds with each other. It doesn't mean you're not nice people. It just means like you've got conflict. And so, you know, what I wrote about when I reflected on Metamom, was conflict resolution. It was like internal conflict. It was interpersonal conflict. It was like spiritual conflict. And so after I had gone through this process in my divorce, I kept having all of these dreams, or like I would meditate and sometimes have visuals of myself sitting between two world leaders, facilitating peace negotiation. And I kept thinking like, I'm just on this side of a working mom. I was barely a working mom. I mean, I was basically staying at home, and I would have all these, like, I was like a serial entrepreneur, a serial small business starter. And I was like, who am I to be sitting between two world leaders? And I kept thinking like, okay, higher self, like I see what you're presenting to me, but it doesn't make any sense because I'm nobody. And then I kind of had like an aha moment where I was like, oh, I see. I'm supposed to be helping negotiate peace between couples, people, work families. And so I did a lot of research on mediation and tried to find like a facet of mediation that would meet me where I was and would make the best use out of my skills. And I realized, and I started reading a lot of books, and every book that I read about mediation, I was like, oh yeah, this is mindfulness. Like, this is my communication. This is what I've been teaching for 6 years. This is what I've been, you know, and it was such a natural progression. I found that the skills required for mediation were the skills that I had already embodied because I had been practicing and committed to my practice for so many years. And so, I think, again, like I'm a creator. And so all kinds of wild things happened to me. And so I had put out a bunch of feelers just asking people in this industry for interviews, or, you know, saying, can you help me find a job? And also, you know, I'm a single mom. I've got a mortgage. Mama needs to work. I need to bring home some bacon. Right. I also needed a full-time job with a steady paycheck. And so I reached out to the gentleman who mediated my divorce. And I said, if you hear of anything that opens, let me know. And a few weeks later, he sent me an email and he's like, there's actually a position open here in this office if you want to come interview for it. And I read the job description and it was me. And I was like, oh, this is my job. Knew it. So I interviewed and got it. And so it's great because now I've got the stability that I need, which is wonderful. And I can also like help to proliferate this amazing practice of mediation. I really think that this is how you do, like, first you, then your neighbor, then the whole world. Conversations are everything. The way we communicate, the way we dialogue, whatever we bring to the table is what we're going to create. And if you can bring to the table peace and composure and openness and really like strong, compassionate, communication skills, then everything's going to be just fine.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of a starting point. And a lot of times, even I'll see couples and the issue is always communication, and it can look lots of different ways, but it is like learning to speak to each other and being able to have hard conversations.
Yeah. And whether it's between couples or friends or parent child, or especially, you know, work, well, not especially, but, and workplace, you know, these workplace mediations are always about communication, always,
right.
You know, tenant, landlord, the conflicts, they're always about communication. The more you can talk to people and tell people what's on your mind, tell people when you're hurting, understand your feelings. That's the other thing. You know, practicing mindfulness allows you to understand your feelings so that when you do want to talk to somebody, you have clarity on who you are, how you feel, and what you want. What do you want? Right. What do you want from this conversation? What do you need from this person right now? And what are some good questions that you can ask so that you can move through a conversation in a way that leaves everybody feeling good? And that's good collaborative conversation, and that's going to lead to peace.
Yeah, it sounds like you've really kind of been able to hone in, like you said, and kind of go through this process yourself and learn about yourself. And as a result, kind of like you said, it's me, then you, then the world. And being able to know that these are the things that help me communicate, and then I can now offer that to other people. Sounds like you've been able to really like use that skill that you've, as you've gone through this journey yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, like in full circle, approaching as much as you can with a sense of levity, joy, humility, humor. If you can laugh at yourself, I think that's very helpful, like starting the process. Just depression, anxiety, conflict. This can be serious business, and it can lead to like very difficult outcomes if it's not treated and dealt with. But as serious as it is, it's important to sort of draw back and find some perspective when you're dealing with any of these problems, and know that the old line, they're not happening to you, they're happening for you. So with that in mind, if you can find some way to treat yourself through joy, through something that's fun, laughing in the face of crappiness. I love to say that. Mm-hmm. Let's laugh in the face of crappiness together. Because you can evolve and heal in a lot of ways. And mm-hmm. some of the ways that we choose to heal and evolve hurt. It's not fun. It doesn't feel good. You don't look forward to it. I hate going to the gym. I don't want to lift weights. That sucks. It hurts. It doesn't, you know, for somebody else, that's great. But for me, that's not. So if I want to get my body in shape, I've got to find a way that I'm going to be compelled to do it again. And actually,
that's good
again.
For you.
Yeah. So, I mean, and so you just have to find that thing that feels good and sparks joy and just keep moving through it and as a way to get to the other side.
Vanessa, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I really enjoy talking with you and talking about the Meta Mom, which is the mindful guide to managing your mood and your brood.
Yeah.
and it does have lots of like prompts at the end of each chapter that kind of like offers some of the experiences that you've been talking about. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Christy. It was really a pleasure to be on your show, and I'm happy that I got the call. What fun.
I know. Thank you. Yeah.
We're all about fun here.
Exactly.